So as we're turning to 1 Samuel 4, what I want to do to set this up, because it's a very lengthy narrative of a lot of lengthy names, you know, places in the ancient Near East that don't really exist anymore. I mean, we're going to hear about Philistia today and the Philistines, and we'll hear about Gaza even today. So I guess in the midst of all of these places that are very foreign and very ancient, so to quote Star Wars, a long, long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, right? There is an importance to this because of the way that God is going to show himself to be radically different than the God of this nation that we're about to look at. So this is the introduction to the Philistines and to their god Dagon. And we heard last week how Samuel essentially had his own Luke 2:52 moment of growing in wisdom and stature and favor with God and man, and all the people heard the word of the Lord that came from Samuel. We're meant to think of Jesus, yes, as New Testament believers, but Samuel here is bringing the word of the Lord, and it's at this point that we come to meet the Philistines. One other point before we get back into this. Do we remember Eli's two sons from last week?
Phineas and
Hophni. Yeah, not necessarily their names, but yeah, praise God that you do know them. What about them? Do we need to recall? What's their
worthless priest?
That's right. They're evil. They're worthless. The King James does a good job of saying they're the sons of Belial, right? Yeah. That's not found in most other translations because I have no idea what that means. But yeah, it's
bad guys.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's so there are so many names for an opposing pagan god when in reality they're just saying, yeah, this is satanic stuff here. Okay. Dagon is going to be another one of those, not in the sense that it's a son of, but we're going to see this highlight of Dagon in a way that the Philistines are, I guess before we get into this, I need to address this part of ancient Near Eastern history. The Christian God of monotheism in history books as they're taught right now in public schools, as well as even at the collegiate level, it tries to present these other religions that have what they would refer to as regional gods. And it's like, this is the god of this land, and that's the god of that land. Not necessarily the ultimate creator god. They don't have that perspective. They have the viewpoint that there are many gods. This one belongs to us. And so we just need to have that in our pocket to say there is a way the Philistines view all the gods, and there should be, I say should, be a radically different way that the Israelites view the God of the covenant and the Old Testament. It's the same God today. So help me out if you would. Could somebody please read 1 Samuel 4, verse 1 and 2? And somebody else, verse 3 and 4, and then we'll stop there at verse 5 and 6.
And the word of the Lord through Samuel came to all Israel. Now Israel went up to meet the Philistines in battle, and they camped beside Ebenezer while the Philistines camped at Aphek. The Philistines assembled in battle formation to meet Israel. And when the battle was over, Israel was defeated by the Philistines, who killed about 4,000 men on the battlefield.
And when the people were coming to the camp, the elders of Israel said, "Wherefore hath the Lord smitten us today before the Philistines? Let us fetch the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord out of Shiloh unto us, that when it cometh among us, it may save us out of the hand of our enemies." So the people sent to Shiloh that they might bring from hence the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of hosts, which dwelleth between the cherubims, and the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were there with the Ark of the Covenant of God.
And when the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord came into the camp, all Israel shouted with a great shout, so that the earth rang again. And when the Philistines heard the noise of the shout, they said, "What meaneth the noise of this great shout in the camp of the Hebrews?" And they understood that the Ark of the Lord was come into the camp.
Yeah. And I'll read verse 7. They panicked. "A god has entered their camp," they said. "Woe to us. Nothing like this has happened before." All right. So prior to this, from the Philistine perspective, this god coming into the camp, what happens to the Israelites?
They were defeated.
Yeah, defeated. There's a little bit of a shock there. To say the least, 4,000 men is quite a lot. And I just want to hone in on verse 3 here. What do you get out of this question and this assurance? Let's go get, let's fetch, let's bring the Ark of the Covenant, and God will save us from our enemies. How are they treating the Ark of the Covenant?
They're trying to bring God to them instead of letting God come to them on his own, or however does it, right?
Kind of a good luck charm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
More superstition.
Superstitious. That's a great word to use. Yeah, like a rabbit's foot or something like that. And it's like, yes.
Is our good luck charm? Yes.
Absolutely. This has given us victory before. We just need to bring this with us. But yeah, Miss Ann, I think it was you who said, or maybe it was Miss Joanne, I'm sorry, who brought up how it's supposed to be God who leads them into battle, not we lost a battle, let's go get our statue. It's also meant to be a change in perspective of seeing the covenant of God, the Ark of the Covenant of God, is probably a lot less like what it's presented as. And Indiana Jones is some kind of relic thing that has some emitting power from it. It's not a relic. It's not a statue. It's not a thing in and of itself. It is a representation of God. It's not God. I think we should just clarify that.
I think the thing, there's some other points that strike me. They recognize the power of God. They know that God's delivered them before and that it's his power. It really would have been the role of the high priest here to advise them that they should have been asking for God's deliverance before they went to battle, see if they even should be going to battle or get out of there. And instead of turning to God to begin with, they kind of do like we do. They say, ready, fire, aim. You know, they act first and then ask God to come in and fix it.
Yeah, well, and that gets to the reason why I think ultimately they go about this the wrong way, is the fact that Hophni and Phinehas are there with the covenant of God. And so they're the ones who allow this to be taken and are essentially giving the A-OK. You guys are on the right track. You just needed the Ark of the Covenant of God, of course. Now you can go out there and win this battle. And the Philistines, I think similar to the book of Joshua, it's just all the nations know what God did for the Israelites back in Egypt. Everyone knows of this story. And so they're panicking. And more than that, the Israelites do have this this war cry. That's how my translation says it in verse 6. The Philistines heard the sound of the war cry. Do I have any other translations there?
Just the noise of the shout.
Noise of the shout?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, well, there's some...
Same aspect, really.
Yeah, there's no real difference there. But just to say... It's a battle cry. It's a let's go get them. I mean, I don't know how many football games you've been to, but there is no power in that's gained by everybody going hoo 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 and chanting in whatever which way they will. It's just it adds to the excitement. Maybe it gets you a little in the right headspace. But it doesn't actually change how strong you are or how capable you are, how talented you are. It's just noise. That's why I asked about the noise.
Well, usually they use that trying to distract. It's just like...
or intimidate.
Intimidate.
Yeah.
That night at Remy's softball game, the opposing team had this recording, and whenever our team was up to bat, they played this real loud music, you know, just to distract the little players, and then they didn't play it any other time, you know, just, and I asked Courtney, I said, is that really legal, you know?
Well, how, remind me, what's the age range for these kids?
Well, Remy.
Remy's six, right?
Yeah, she's, what, she'll be seven or so, you know?
Yeah.
But, you know, five to nine, I think, is the actual...
It's not exactly the NBA finals.
No,
like, let's just put it that way.
And, you know, and of course they teach them to, you know, do that noise.
The hey, batter, batter, or whatever.
That's what they used to do.
So I guess, but I thought, man, that's high technology just to, you know, to...
Throw a six-year-old off their game.
Yeah, to distract them with this music.
Well, I think that's the intended impact, I think. I mean, they really do. It says they shook the ground with how loud it was. And the Philistines believe that a god has really entered their camp. So they've been part of this rah-rah, bis-boom-bah before and said, wow, how theologically robust and spiritually exciting. God is in our midst. Look how loud we are. It's just a fun little comment on today's view of what makes a worshipful experience or a life-changing experience sometimes is just, it was just loud. That's all it was. Anyway, but they move on here and they do bring up in verse 8 how they slaughtered the Egyptians with all kinds of plagues. That'll come back in a second here. But verse 9, they rally the troops. Show some courage and be men, Philistines. Otherwise, you'll serve the Hebrews just as they served you. Now be men and fight. And so they did. Verse 10, so the Philistines fought and Israel was defeated and each man fled to his tent. The slaughter was severe. 30,000 of the Israelite foot soldiers fell. The Ark of God was captured, and Eli's two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, died. So there you go. Prophecy fulfilled, right? We read about that being foretold just last week. And I don't want to breeze past this number. We're in the day and age where the news headline is never even featuring the number of deaths. It's just a lot of people died, all right? Let me tell you where it was and what were the details, what caused it. You want to know what malfunctioned in the airplane. You don't really need to know how many people in India died or... I'm sorry, just to talk about something last week where just the number just seemed to disappear. And it doesn't hit you. So 30,000 people, 30,000 troops, ground soldiers... I'm trying to think of a good comparison. Man. I mean, 9/11, what was it, 3,000 lives that were lost? So 10 times that in a day, in a single battle. It's meant to strike at the heart of what in the world, God, where are you? You know, it's meant to provoke that kind of question in you. And I think Eli has the same response as the story goes on. One of the people from the battle came to Shiloh. And when he arrived there, verse 13, there was Eli sitting on his chair beside the road watching because he was anxious about the Ark of God. That's interesting. I wonder what's going to happen to the Ark of God, you know, just as the high priest at that time, and your two sons who have already been cursed by God, I'm worried about the Ark of God. When the man entered the city to give a report, the entire city cried out. That kind of gives you a picture of how news actually travels. because the we're told in verse 12, I'm sorry, that there was dirt on this man's head and his clothes were all torn. He's a raggedy looking fellow. Verse 14, Eli heard the outcry and asked, "Why this commotion?" The man came quickly and reported to Eli. At that time, Eli was 98 years old, and his eyes didn't move because he couldn't see. Verse 16, the man said to Eli, "I'm the one from the battle. I fled from there today. What happened, my son?" Eli asked. The messenger answered, "Israel has fled from the Philistines, and also there was a great slaughter among the people. Your two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, are both dead, and the ark of God has been captured." Verse 18, when he mentioned the ark of God, Eli fell backward off the chair by the city gate, and since he was old and heavy, his neck broke and he died. Eli had judged Israel 40 years. So there's something in the Bible that's very, very interesting, that when it's usually at the introduction of a character or at the end of a character, this time at its end, his end. We're told that Eli broke his neck because of his weight. This is actually a really important word just in the Old Testament. It's a kavod. It's talking about, sorry, a little Hebrew for you this morning. We're going to see it here several times in just a moment. That's why I bring it up. But it's talking about the weightiness of him, and kind of where it would be wrong to be weighty. There is a weightiness that God's people need, and kind of his weight in his, he was unable to see, and he is unable to do, for that matter. He's sitting in a chair waiting on a report, and he falls out of this chair and dies. A lot of times when you think of the physical descriptions of somebody in the Bible, it's almost describing their spiritual condition, which is why the Israelites probably, as we're going to see in a little bit, saw Saul head and shoulders above the rest. He's good looking. They might have even thought about someone like Joseph, you know. He's easy on the eyes, you know, well built. Genesis is just weird with how descriptive and how good looking and attractive they make Joseph sound. But here you have the opposite side of it. Here's somebody who can't see. He's unable. And he can't move, and if he did, well, he's going to fall and break his neck. He's weighty in all the wrong ways. And so as a high priest, he's unable to do things for God's people. He's unable to see or give any kind of spiritual insight to prevent all of this chaos that's happening. It really is interesting, and we'll come back to it in a second. There's too much that's being set up by everything right now, just from a literary standpoint. But then we're told, and I'm not going to read everything here, but Eli's daughter-in-law, the wife of Phinehas, was pregnant. And when she hears the news, it sends her into labor. Verse 20, as she was dying, the woman taking care of her said, "Don't be afraid, you've given birth to a son." But she doesn't care. She did not respond. Verse 21, here's the weightiness again. She named the boy Ichabod. Or the opposite of kavod, ichavod, right? This idea that there is no weightiness, but it's specific because she explains. Can I get somebody else actually to read verse 21 and 22?
And she named the child Ichabod, saying, "The glory is departed from Israel because the ark of God was taken, and because of her father-in-law and her husband." And she said, "The glory is departed from Israel, for the ark of God is taken."
Yeah. Yeah, it's the way that it's structured kind of literally is almost in the form of a question, his name. Where is God's glory? Right? Where is God's glory? Most literally, it just means there is no glory. There's none. Maybe you can think about Ichabod Crane and the Headless Horseman and all that stuff. It's meant to be playing on that a little bit. You have this guy who's just scared, witless, right? There's nothing in him. He can be blown away by a breeze, and that's pretty much all that happens to him. He gets scared. But here, you have a boy who is named directly because God is not with his people. There's no weight. There's no kavod. All right. It's from here, of all places, that God takes over, in a sense. It's in the defeat of God's people that actually God gets to have a victory. Anything else you'd like to pursue before we go on?
It is kind of interesting how God works through people as he did the wrong person that Abraham had a child with first. Mm. You know, that sometimes God uses people that wouldn't be used, but God uses them anyway. And, so I think he's kind of announcing that, you know, he was gone before the ark left.
Yeah.
That you guys botched it, that your father-in-law and your husband were the problem, not the fixer.
Yeah, and what we need to talk about is why God's presence isn't with them. Because I want to say this is not God's fault. If anything, this is God keeping his promises as a good father. He told them in Deuteronomy, and maybe you remember this specifically about the end of Deuteronomy. It's this giant warning coming from Moses that says, you will be exiled, right? Don't worship the other gods, because when you do, you'll be exiled. So what happens in this story, as we're about to find out, is God exiles himself. God leaves, and the Israelites get to stay, but they lose the battle, right? So they still have the promised land. They've not been sent to Babylon yet. That will happen. But at this time, it's really interesting how God is the one who is taken out of the land, taken to Philistia. And I just think that's one of those things where God is taking on the punishment that his people deserved. And what's going to come about from it? Their redemption. Their enemies being defeated. So
maybe it's a kind of rabbit trail, but, you know, there again, you know, the stories and the historical things of the scripture are so relevant and pertinent to the things that are going on in our lifetime. This whole thing in Israel right now is an incredible movement of God. So you had the Palestinians who invaded Israel and killed a couple of thousand people. In October.
Almost 2 years ago. Yeah.
Set off the thing to destroy Hamas. Hamas was one of the bad hombres supported by Iran. So did they? Well, really, the powerhouse over there that was anti-Israel was not Hamas. They were relatively smaller, but they had a lot of rockets they got from Iran. So the real powerhouse was Hezbollah. So one reason that Israel was not more prepared when they got invaded, if you will, by Hamas down in Gaza, was because their eyes were really on Hezbollah, which is like got 10 times the army and military.
Yeah.
I mean, they're all seated around in Lebanon. So,
well, it's actually one with a real government, whereas Hamas is just kind of its own thing.
Except they controlled Gaza.
Yeah.
But so they had been preparing, Israel had been preparing for a long, long time because they felt their threat was from Hezbollah. So they had some things that they had an opportunity, I guess, because Hezbollah knew that they couldn't use cell phones because cell phones will track you. They will show people where you are.
Or blow up on you.
And so they couldn't use them. So they had pagers. And they were going to use pagers. And Israel...
Where was it they got them from again? Was that Turkey?
Lebanon.
The pagers were manufactured, not even from Israel. They were from some, I think it was Turkey, I can't remember.
Yes, so they intercept the shipment and they jimmy up the pagers, So now they had videos of these guys. They're in the market, and their hip blows off. It blows their leg off, you know. So they're, and so you know who the bad guys are because they're the guys wearing the pagers. The only reason they're wearing the pagers is because their Hezbollah, they were wearing pagers because when the military call came, it was going to come through the pagers. So it blew up all the military guys. So you took Hamas out of the equation, you took Hezbollah out of the equation, which really kind of disarms Iran because that was
their stuff.
That's who they were going to. And now, then when they attacked, they wiped out their air defense. I mean, the hand of God is so clear, and there are people with YouTube videos about what's going on over there because our media is so lousy that they do give God all the glory, I think.
And, yeah.
And it is obvious that the hand of God's at work. So if God chooses to save the day, you have Jericho, the walls fall down.
Yeah.
If you take that for granted and you go marching through like it's like somebody described here, the people in our day see their God as a spare tire. Like you carry him in the trunk until you really need him and then you call him out.
That's about right.
And so that's kind of how I see what they're doing with the Ark in this thing that was kind of their token. You know, we'll bring out the heavy artillery.
Yeah.
We'll bring the Ark with us. Well, you know, it's not about the Ark, it's about God. And he wasn't happy with that. And who should have been the one person that knew that the most and
hopefully
saw to it that happened?
Eli and his two kids.
Still getting fat.
Yeah.
And he fell off the thing and he's toast. Broke his back.
All right, let's keep talking about the let's keep talking about the hand of God, because it's really interesting if you pay attention to how Dagon responds to the Ark of the Covenant. Dagon is just a statue thing, but it's the Philistines' god. Can I get some help? Verse 1 and 2, and then someone else, verse 3 and 4. And we'll stop there. Actually, we'll go on. We'll read verse 5 and 6, and then we'll stop. There's just something funny in verse 6 I want to read. verse 1 and 2.
So then the Philistines took the Ark of God and brought it from Ebenezer to Ashdod. When the Philistines took the Ark of God, they brought it into the house of Dagon and set it by Dagon.
When the people of Ashdod got up early the next day, behold, Dagon had fallen on his face on the ground before the Ark of the Lord. So they took Dagon and returned him to his place. But when they got up early the next morning, behold, Dagon had again fallen on his face on the ground before the Ark of the Lord. And his head and both palms of his hands were lying cut off on the threshold. Only the trunk portion of the idol of Dagon was left on him.
Therefore, neither the priests of Dagon nor any that came into Dagon's house tread on the threshold of Dagon in Ashdod unto this day. But the hand of the Lord was heavy upon them of Ashdod, and he destroyed them and smote them with emeralds, even Ashdod and the coast thereof.
All right. This is just... It's almost hilarious. Just the way it's being pictured is the statue falling down as if in worship, and then I hope you caught this here. Dagon here, with his head being chopped off, being decapitated essentially by just being in the presence of the Ark of the Covenant. If that doesn't make you think of the promise in Genesis 3:15, I don't know what will, to talk about the head of the serpent being crushed. You know. What's going to happen when a Philistine giant faces off against a small child shepherd boy from Israel? What's his end? Yeah, he decapitates him. It's the exact same picture that we get presented here.
It's very typical in that land in their day as well, that was the ultimate symbol of defeat. So when you see all those Roman statues and all the things that they've dug up archaeologically, and they have no head.
Yeah,
it's because that's what you did. If you defeated another people, you knocked the heads off all their statues.
Yeah,
that was a sign you had defeated them.
Yeah, well.
Yeah, and they took the heads and hung them up, and then, you know, they took them down, you know, at evening time. But that reminds you of how the Indians, you know, defeated the people. I mean, they always scalped them, you know.
Mm.
And hung their scalps up, that was it, like a trophy, you know, cut their heads off. Settlers and stuff, so.
Right, and it's meant to be their power as a warrior or as a tribe. I think something similar is going on here. The whole reason why you would do this is, one, as a trophy room to say, we beat your God. But then to not desecrate it in any way is almost as if to saying, because we beat you, your God now works for our God. The God of the Israelites and whatever region you guys have is now going to start doing some business for Philistia. We're going to reap some benefits from your God. And that is exactly how they viewed it. Essentially, when the people would war, they viewed it from a deific standpoint as if the gods are battling. Whoever wins this battle is proving which God was more powerful. And I love how God himself just subverts that entirely, because it's not just the head being cut off, as you just brought up. What's the other aspect of Dagon that's removed? His hands. And then the explanation to immediately contrast that in verse 6 is the Lord's hand was what?
Heavy.
Heavy. There's that word, kavod, glorious. It's one and the same. It's all about the context in which you use it, but the word there is still the same as the glory of the Lord, the weight of the Lord, or the heaviness. Or you can think about the fat king that was assassinated back in the book of Judges. It was a king who had a lot of glory. And I don't know. Anyway.
Sort of reminds you of Joseph, too, or of Pharaoh,
mm.
When Moses was confronting Pharaoh, really, yeah. All those 10 plagues represented idols that the Egyptians recognized.
Absolutely, yeah.
It was God defeating, showing that he defeated all their idols. Their idols were nothing.
Yeah, absolutely. It's fun to go one by one there. We do kind of need to take account here for what happens next. Miss Ann, would you remind me in verse 6, yours had an interesting translation for the way God afflicted them.
He gave him hemorrhoids, is what it amounts to. Hemorrhoids meant, yeah. Hemorrhoids.
Okay, so mine comes out as tumors, but yours sounds worse. Neither one sounds great, wow. God's afflicting them in invisible ways. It says if you can see the affliction on other people, to say it's not boils, which is what happened to the Egyptians, but you have growth coming out of you. It's not, my goodness. It really does make me a little squeamish, I'm sorry. But their response, and I want to think about this for a second, because this is really the discussion of today, is the response of the Philistines is not, clearly we've made a mistake. The God of Israel is clearly the God over all things, and their people are just a little bit screwy. They messed up. Dare I say it, hypocritical, right? What's the most common insult you hear about Christians, or the reason why people aren't Christians? All Christians are hypocrites. Well, you know who's not? Jesus. The God of the Bible is not hypocritical. But I just think about this so often, where someone is confronted with something miraculous, something salvific, something that's unexplainable in any other way, or even just they encounter you, and maybe they knew you before Christ, and things have radically changed. Their response is not, maybe I should look at Jesus, but good for you.
Let's get rid of this ark, because evidently the ark is the one that's causing all this trouble. So let's,
yeah,
move it out. Get rid of it.
Yeah. I mean, I think about family members of mine who have dealt with certain addictions. I think of one in particular who struggled with drugs when they were younger. They're now in their 40s and have cleaned up their act significantly. But their friends, who are still in the thick of it, so to speak, say, wow, I should really think about getting off of drugs. And you're like, wow, what a novel thought, right? And his response to them is, no, drugs was not my biggest problem. Would you believe the fact that I thought I should be in charge of my life? That was my biggest problem. And then he tells them about Jesus and how he starts living according to what the Bible has to say for his life. And his friend's response is always, that's nice for you. You know, it's always looking at the surface level thing. Doctor, I don't care what's wrong with me. Just treat the symptoms, right? I don't care about these inner things that are causing the symptoms. Just treat the symptoms, right? It's that kind of attitude. I think that that we shouldn't be surprised at when the world sees something truly amazing that God does, and all they say is, thanks for being a Christian, rather than saying, I need to get my life together. I need to give my life to Christ.
That's kind of funny because I'm dealing with the situation with my stomach right now, and I'm begging the doctor to find out what's causing it, and he just wants to treat the symptoms.
Ugh.
You know, by telling me just to take more gas X and Tums and all that stuff, you know. But I tell him that I shouldn't have to do that, that there's a reason, you know, because I know that my food is not being digested, correctly. But there again, they just come back to, well, when you get older, things just don't work like they used to. It makes me so mad, I just want to smack them.
That's
true. Wear out. I mean, that's what they tell you, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, absolutely, yeah.
And, you know, things just wear out. You know, your body parts just wear out. Well, I'm not dumb. I wasn't born yesterday. I might have been born the day before, but, you know, I know that things wear out, but there has to be a reason.
You don't want to wear them out any earlier than you need to, right?
That's exactly right.
So, yeah, it's an attitude that I think is.
And see, the thing that really gets me worse than anything, I want them to either run an MRI or a CAT scan or something and see if there is a problem. Oh, well, you know, they wouldn't do anything, you know, and. Well, how do you know? And it's not going to cost you a dime. My insurance will pay for it, so why do you care? All I have to do is get you to say, let's do it.
You got to exaggerate your pain when you go in.
Well, I don't know how much worse
you
want me to say than
I'm going to.
A dime! You know?
Yeah.
I believed you just now. Gosh, that scared me.
Like this friend of mine, I didn't report him this morning, but I should have. This friend of mine, and he's young. I mean, he's the age of I think him and Andy or him and Greg, and I say young, they're in their 60s now, but to me that's young. He's got an aneurysm on his heart.
On his heart?
On his heart. And
wow.
It's at 0.4. No, it's at 4 point something, but they won't do anything about it until it's 5 point something. And so the doctor said, well, there's complications involved, but the biggest complication is the insurance won't pay for it until it's 5 point.
When that's the biggest that, complication?
It's stupid, because
yeah.
You know good and well, I mean, common sense tells you that if you take care, and what it entails is whenever it gets to that point, it could rupture, and it could kill him immediately, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But they won't go in, but it has to be removed whenever it's whatever it is, and wherever it is, it involves a surgical procedure. Well, it looks like to me that it would be much simpler to take it out before it gets so bad, but they won't.
Well,
they're going to watch him.
Well, trying to save up my political points to only use them when I can, this is the kind of thinking, though, that gets you to where New York is at, where they are heavily looking into assisted suicide, because they're like, look, it's complicated. Insurance companies, I don't want to get into it. At a certain age, we'll just help you die, all right?
See, that's what I'm saying.
But I'm saying, I guess, that comes from a certain worldview that says the second you become difficult to take care of, we're done, you know?
Exactly.
And I want to say that it's this kind of worldview. It's the one that refuses to see the miracle that life is and the point and fact of it. God wants us to live. That's one of the starting promises you get from the time you're a kid. Honor your mom and dad, and you'll get to live longer.
Well,
like, you know, what a promise.
You know, because, I mean, here he's made these people so smart, you know, I mean, he's given them wisdom and knowledge to extend your life and to take care of you, and yet then they turn around and say, well, you know, it gets to be a point where we're not going to use that knowledge, you know, I mean, it's just...
Well, it starts treating people like commodities, as if to say your worth was only wrapped up in what you did as a career or something like that. It boils down human existence to, are you an Olympic athlete right now? Or are you at least out there making movies for us? We like those old people, you know? It's a scary, slippery slope, and it's kind of the exact same argument that gets made for abortion. You know, well, and no one really wants that life to be there. So what? Let's think about the resources here. Let's think about it logically. And that's how they try to create logic where there is none.
Well, and you know, when you get to the point where you're not working anymore and you're not paying into that fund, and see, I worked longer probably, basically, and paid into it, then some of these guys are alive, you know what I mean? Because I worked till I was 72. So, I mean, come on, don't I deserve that? It's crazy.
I want to make one final comment.
Too many illegals to take care of.
Well,
that's true. Right.
Well, and another part of the reason of trying to put systems in place and all that, but this isn't a conversation about creating a theocracy or going back to trust in Israel as the only source of where God comes from and who gets to say what God is and who He is. Verse 5, I want to come back to this idea because here is the thing that really is not superstitious, but as one of my Old Testament professors used to say, stupidstitious. Because in verse 5, we're told, therefore, or that is why, still today, the priests of Dagon in Ashdod do not step on Dagon's threshold because their statue fell down there. That's where the statue, well, you can't be where that statue was, the one that fell and had his head cut off and his hands cut off so he couldn't do anything. Don't step there. It's this remarkable thing where they are staring the stupidity and foolishness of their God, of their own beliefs in the face and saying, well, we just need to make a new caveat in our faith that now we'll no longer stand in that spot. We're going to walk around that area because as we know, Dagon just had a hard day. Absolutely. And that's what we're going to see in the rest of the chapter here. I know what time it is, but I'm just going to summarize in the following verses here. Because of the affliction, essentially because of the plagues, They asked for this ark to be moved away, but there's an outbreak of tumors even when they send it all the way to Gath, which is the city of Goliath, in case you want to know. And then the people of Gath, verse 10, the people of Gath send the ark of God to Ekron, and they are the ones who say, nope, get it out of here, it's going to kill us. And then the Ekronites called on all the Philistine rulers together. They said, send the ark of Israel's God away and let it return to its place so it won't kill us and our people. For the fear of death pervaded the city. God's hand was oppressing them. Those who did not die were afflicted with tumors, and the outcry of the city went up to heaven. It's remarkable. I'm not going to get into all this here. But they continue this foolishness. I want to start from chapter 7 next week. They continue this foolishness in the way that they construct in chapter 6, verse 4, halfway through. They say, we're going to make a guilt offering, which they don't really have any theological system to come up with that. It's like they overheard the Israelites talking about guilt offerings and how they atone for their wrongs. And they answered, 5 gold tumors and 5 gold mice, corresponding to the number of Philistine rulers. Make these images of these tumors and mice that are destroying the land. Give glory to Israel's God. Perhaps he'll stop oppressing you, your gods, and your lands. Why harden your hearts, Jim, as you mentioned earlier, as the Egyptians and Pharaoh hardened theirs? When he afflicted them, didn't they send Israel away and Israel left? So they suppose they're going to tie up 2 milk cows, just to summarize the whole passage, as in not oxen who are used to carrying and pulling things. They're used to being with their babies and nursing them. Tie them up together, put a yoke on them. They've never had a yoke before. If they go back to Israel, great. That was the problem. We just had to get rid of this God. And if they come back to their babies, their calves, which we're going to keep here in Philistines, then it was just a coincidence. Yeah. It was some plague from these mice. So they're just covering all their bases, trying to come up with any explanation other than the God of Israel. And would you believe the Philistines continue to be the greatest problem to the Israelites after these 2 random dairy cows who have no business pulling a cart take the Ark of the Covenant of God all the way back to Israel? They continue, they double down in their idolatry, and Israel, if anything, proves to be just as off base in their worship as the Philistines. That's our God. He's willing to be exiled for us, fight our enemies on their own terms, and bring back the victory being carried by a couple of dumb cows. Is there anything our God can't do? You know. Yeah.
Interesting that they made gold tumors and mice.
Yeah.
Why would you pick those 2 things?
That's what plagued them.
It's as if they're saying,
get rid of it. I don't know.
They were making idols out of the thing they said had power. The Israelites saying, let's make a golden cow, because they are essentially just claiming something along the lines of the Hindus, even, and saying, this is a holy thing that got us out of here. No, it's not. You're making it up. You just made it out of gold. It looks shiny. It looks nice. Like when you go into the stores that are rip-off Chinese places because they're not actually owned by Chinese people, and they're selling little golden statues of Buddha. Buddha had no concept of being worshipped, didn't want to be worshipped. And now all these little people are like, look how cute. It's just something nice and neat to look at. You got to go, Jim? Yeah, you're good, brother. Thank you. Sorry, I cut you off, Miss Lissa.
She said, no, I just told
him that. Okay. Yeah. Verse 19 kind of summarizes everything that's happened. God struck down the people of Beth Shemesh because they looked inside the Ark of the Covenant. He struck down 70 persons, and the people mourned because the Lord struck them with a great slaughter. The people of Beth Shemesh asked, who is able to stand in the presence of the Lord, his holy God? To whom should the ark go from here? They sent messengers to the residents of Kiriath Jearim, saying, the Philistines have returned the ark of the Lord. Come down and get it. And chapter 7 starts out with where it goes from here. God's own people don't know how to handle his presence. That's a terrible sign. And so I guess the question for us becomes, do we know how to explain what it means that God's in our midst, that we're people who are defined by God staying with us? This is what we're talking about on Sunday mornings in Acts, to say that we're a spirit-powered people. We have power because God is with us. That's the end-all, be-all. We're not the smartest, we're not the strongest, we're not the wisest, but we have God. What else is there?
Did you want to comment on that?
I do not. Yeah. Sometimes I just like to let things hang in the air.
That's the only difference, right, between us and heathens?
That really is it. It seems like sometimes we make those same mistakes too.
Yeah, sometimes we're heathens.
That's right. Yeah. Redeemed heathens. There you go. All right. Let's close in prayer. Father, we do love you, and we thank you that your word to us speaks volumes about understanding our world today and truly our dependence on you. It cannot be overstated that you are the one who called us out of darkness and brought us into your glorious presence. And I pray that we would bask there, that we'd pray along with David and Psalm 27, that there's nothing else that I want, just one thing, to stand before your presence and worship there, basking in your glory and in your beauty. I pray that that's our heart this week, that we would look for ways and opportunities to worship you, and to be thankful that you are giving your weight to our lives. The importance of every single moment is ours because you've given it to us. You put breath in our lungs, and we're meant to use it to worship. We thank you and praise you in the powerful name of Jesus Christ. Amen.